Brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, I suppose in some ways, this afternoon is a more negative topic. We talked about yesterday, in the context of secular music, that good and better sort of music that we should aspire to. And this afternoon we're going to spend a little bit of time, unfortunately, looking at some of the music that perhaps we should avoid. Actually, I've started by talking about rock music this afternoon, which I'm going to do shortly. I'm sure you'll all look forward to that. But we hope to expand some thoughts out on some other types of music this afternoon as well. And so what I'm going to do is perhaps not run quite as long this afternoon, so that we do have time to stop, and then we can begin on any questions that people have. I'm not sure, Brother Chairman, whether you want to have a formal break between this session and the question session or not, but if that's the case, I think that's what we'll do. We'll close off and then we'll open it again for questions for those that wish to remain, so that we can actually explore any uncharted territory that you feel hasn't been covered. I don't guarantee to have an answer on every song, but I certainly may have some thoughts on some of the underlying principles. You know, we're under attack, really, because, you see, this is what's happening. This is a very interesting article from an extract from the Humanist magazine, and this is all the way back to 1983. So this is over 15 years ago, and it says, "I'm convinced that the battle for humankind's future must be waged and won in the public classroom by teachers who correctly perceive their role as proselytizers of the new faith, a religion of humanity that recognizes and respects the spark of divinity in every human being. These teachers must embody the same dedication as the most rabid fundamentalist preachers, for they will be ministers of another sort, utilizing the classroom instead of the pulpit to convey humanist values. The classroom must and will become an arena of conflict between the old and the new, the rotting corpse of Christianity and the new faith of humanism." Well, there it is, brothers and sisters. There's the battle set before us, and it's considered to be a battle by those who would preach this doctrine. They see it as a religion. They see it as a faith. They consider themselves to be ministers. But notice that they said that the pulpit is now the classroom. Of course, you know what the tragedy is? That we're too late, aren't we? That battle's already been fought and won. You do know that, don't you? That battle's already been well and truly lost, as far as the truth's concerned, in the school system today. Humanism is triumphant. And every little child that enters the school is told, "You are such an important and unique person." And they come home immediately with humanistic values that says that the world revolves around me. And I'm actually terribly important. In fact, I'm much more important than I realized before I went to school. They arrive at school at 5, and the teacher sits down and she says, "Let's all sit in a nice circle together." And they all sit in a big circle together, including the teacher, who's only one of the circle, of course, and they all put in their thoughts, and they have a democratic election for the committee for that particular classroom, and the child goes home thinking that they're rather important. And we wonder why there's conflicts when they get home, to find that mum and dad actually don't take kindly to the view that little Johnny's thoughts are just as valuable as mum and dad's. And humanism is rampant in every part of society. Now, we know that the great antithesis of humanism is God manifestation, which at the heart of it comes down to this idea, brothers and sisters, that we intrinsically believe that the core of the truth rests on this foundation, that Yahweh is supreme, not man. And humanism says man is supreme. It shouts at us, it screams at us, it shrieks at us. The fundamental idea of humanism has told us every day of our lives. And you know what happens is people say, yeah, I've heard about all that before. I tell you what, brothers and sisters, that's probably the one great thing that will overthrow the truth. And we talk about God manifestation, and people say, oh yes, I've heard all that before as well. But you know, I think that that still is the great challenge in the truth, in understanding God manifestation and the setting of every aspect of our life in the context of God manifestation versus the danger of humanism. If you want to know whether an ecclesia and whether people understand God manifestation, I'll give you an infallible guide. Just listen to the prayers. Only thing, you know, sometimes you hear prayers that are couched in ever so nice a tone and the right words, but when you actually listen very, very carefully, you'll find that what the prayer says is, "We thank thee for the help thou hast given us, for blessings, for abundance. And we ask that thou wilt watch over us, care for us, guide us, mould us, direct us, lead us, and bring us at last, and give us a place in thy kingdom." And you suddenly realize that it's actually the prayer of humanism. It's got nothing to do with the supremacy of God. It's actually got nothing to do with the advancing of God's purpose. It's all still about me. Listen to the prayers. They are an infallible guide as to whether God manifestation is truly understood. Like a set of spectacles, brothers and sisters, you take them off and you have a completely different view on life. You put them on and you see things, you see issues in a completely different way. Well, I think music's one of those things. We've got to be very careful what set of spectacles we wear, and we've got to see everything through the light of God manifestation and what it is that the Father would have us to do. Let me just remind you of these principles that we looked at yesterday, because they just set the scene again for this afternoon, don't they? So firstly, in terms of the words, we're looking for that which is not corrupt, but that which is pure. In terms of the beat, we're looking not for the offbeat, but for that which is rhythmic. And in terms of the sound, we're looking not for that which is jarring, but for that which is harmonious. Now the problem is that there's a great deal of music out there that in fact doesn't fulfil those conditions, and therefore becomes part of the music that is less than ideal, and there are harmful associations that we need to both recognise and learn to avoid. So let me give you some facts now about bad music, just to sort of get us underway. Firstly, let me just quote you an article on the matter of tensions and resolutions in music. And basically what this article says is this. This is from an article entitled, "How Music Affects Your Kids, What Parents Need to Know." And what it says is this. It says, measures represent how many beats you count for each unit of time. Musical pies have what is called a time signature, which for most popular music these days is 4/4 time. This means there are 4 beats to every measure, and every beat gets represented by what's called a quarter note. In a measure with 4 beats like this, the strong beats are represented by beats 1 and 3. Beat 3 is the complement of 1 because it divides the measure in half. When a musician or singer accents any beats with notes they play or sing that are not the strong beats of the measure, you have what is called syncopation. This is a common technique used for introducing levels of tension into the music. It's a very effective technique which is used in classical music. The difference is with most popular music today, and especially rock music, the syncopation happens throughout the entire song without any let-up. The tension remains without resolution. In classical music, whenever syncopation is used, the composer quickly resolves the syncopation back to accenting the strong beats. If you pay attention to this, you can feel your body and mind feel resolved and relaxed from the tension when the music gets back with accents on the strong beats. With rock music, the weak beats are accented very forcefully. The snare drum usually hits with a big pop, which often sounds like somebody banging on a trash can lid, right on beats 2 and 4 of every measure without let up. In addition to this, there are further syncopations put into the music by both the musician and also the singers. The difference then between classical music and most popular music today is that classical composers resolve these tensions right after introducing them,
In contrast, most popular music today never resolves the tensions. And then he says this, I want you to listen to this bit carefully, because this is the conclusion that he draws. Music is supposed to mirror and enhance our lives. When the music has tension and release, it mirrors how our lives should be. We thrive on challenges and victories. Without these, life is very boring and purposeless. On the other hand, when music has tension without any release, it tells the body and the mind of the listener, you might as well give up. There's never ever going to be any let up to the tension, and there never will be any victories in your life. Makes you think, doesn't it? But that's the actual effect of the music, simply because of the way that the beating works. Now, this particular article goes on to talk about a fellow who was an expert in what's called muscle testing. And the standard test for allergies, or one of the standard tests for allergies, I don't know if it is. Has anyone done an allergy test holding out their hand against resistance? Anyone actually done that allergy test? I see one or two hands at the back. The theory is that if you hold in this hand something that your body doesn't like, and someone else is pressing down on this hand, that normally you can resist the pressure to a reasonable degree, but the moment you hold something your body is allergic to, the muscles in the arm drop. You lose all power. And as a result of that, they are able to push down your arm very quickly and easily. Well, they've done this testing on music, and this particular scientist has tested 20,000 different pieces of music. That's quite a lot. I'd say that's a fairly good sample. And he tested this in terms of muscle tests, loss of muscle tone when certain types of music were played. In fact, the particular person who wrote this article, what he did was, he actually put on a set of earphones that played what's called white noise, which is simply static being played through the earphones, so that he couldn't hear anything else. And then he got his friend to actually twiddle with the knobs of a radio, and to actually change stations, from station to station to station to station, while he maintained pressure on his arm, to see if anything would come up in the music that would suddenly affect his arm to lose muscle power. And he found, surprisingly, that it did. That his friend, who was doing the test, turned the knob, and when a certain piece of music came on, he said his arm fell to his side like a limp rag. In fact, he was so astounded by the loss of strength that he began to laugh hysterically, because he said, I never would have believed it. He didn't know what it was. He couldn't hear anything because he had white noise being played in his ears. He didn't know what the music on the radio was. All he knew was that his arm suddenly fell to his side and lost every particle of strength. It was actually a Beatles song. Now, what's interesting is that this particular scientist has tested 20,000 pieces of music, and in 20,000 pieces of music, he only found 2 pieces of classical music where that loss of muscle power ever occurred. And in both cases, which was a piece by Ravel and The Rites of Spring by Stravinsky, the composer was deliberately, at that moment of time in the music, endeavouring to provide the feeling of chaos in life. So he wasn't surprised that the music perhaps provided loss of muscle tone. So that's exactly what the composer was trying to achieve in that particular piece of music at that time. But outside of that, classical music never had this effect. Strange. They did an interesting test in the factory. They had a problem with components being assembled by the factory team, both in terms of productivity being pretty poor and also mistakes in the manufacturing and in the assembly process. And in the factory, which was probably common in a lot of factories, they were playing music from the local radio station, which was basically a blend of light pop and more light pop. And someone suggested that they change the music in the factory, on the factory floor, and they switched to classical music. And 3 things happened simultaneously, all of which are rather interesting. The first thing is that the productivity in the factory went up just like that, skyrocketed. The productivity of the factory workers suddenly leapt. The second thing is that whilst the productivity went up, the number of mistakes went down. So 2 things happened side by side. They got much more productive and they made far less mistakes. You know, the third thing was that happened. The factory workers complained bitterly about the change of music. Now, here's an interesting thing. You see, they didn't like the music. But what they didn't realise was that that music actually enhanced their creativity, their ability, their concentration, their focus, their productivity, their output, lowered their error rate, and they didn't like it. Funny thing, you see, because what that tells us is this, and it's a great lesson here, that you see, one of the great lessons about music is you can develop a taste even for that which is harmful. And what they've found in study after study after study is if you wash yourself in the wrong music for long enough, in the end you'll have a craving for it, even though it actually harms your body, you still want it. In one rock concert, they took a set of eggs, put them on the front of the stage, raw eggs in their shells, pop, 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 on the front of the stage. Halfway through the concert, the eggs were hard-boiled. Not because of heat, but because of the vibration from the music. Just the vibration from the guitars and the songs of the rock concert boiled the eggs. Imagine what it might be doing to human brains. Amazing stuff. So you see, there's music that's not good, really not good in any way. And remember here, I'm not even talking about the words. I'm simply talking about the music itself. Is that, well, listen to these words from a very interesting article by a chap called Kilpatrick, who's a noted a professor of education in the States, and he wrote a book called Why Johnny Can't Tell Right from Wrong. Very good book. He says here, one question that logically arises here is whether rock can be reformed. Some seem to think it can be, that it's simply a matter of changing the lyrics or attaching the music to a proper course. Thus teachers use rock in classrooms, educational films are made with rock soundtracks, and thus we have Christian rock and even Christian versions of rock magazines. The idea is that the energy of rock can somehow be channeled towards virtuous ends. This hope, it seems to me, arises from a basic misunderstanding about the nature of rock. I've already indicated that though the lyrics are important, they are secondary. The music is its own message. No matter what the words might say, the music speaks the language of self-gratification. Rock can't be made respectable. It doesn't want to be respectable. A respectable rock is a contradiction in terms. Some dreamers have hoped to harness rock to propagate the values of transcendent ideologies, writes Robert Patterson. But Patterson, who has written what is perhaps the definitive book on the rock myth, argues that rock in its essence is vulgar and narcissistic, based on a denial of any value outside the self. So while it is possible to set a Christian hymn or a song about undying love to the beat of rock, it cannot be done convincingly. The music will simply subvert the words. That's interesting, isn't it? The music will simply subvert the words. So you see, there is music that is in itself harmful, no matter what we might do about it. Now, I'm going to play you a tape. It's probably interesting to play this tape because here we are sitting in the hall, the ecclesial hall. And we've just had a memorial meeting. This is Sunday. This is the Lord's Day. So this is going to feel really funny. So we're going to listen to good music and bad music side by side in the ecclesial hall. And so I want you to listen now to several extracts. There's not many of them, they're just put together. Look, these were put together by my daughter the night before I left, and she likes classical music, so she may be a little biased in what she's done. But I know what she did do. She simply took some extracts from some classical music, and then she simply punched the button for several radio stations and took a snap from several radio stations, just whatever was there at the time, no particular choosing, just whatever came out. And I want you to have a listen now to this particular tape. It's not very long. And I want you to listen to the beat, to the rhythm, to the sound, and maybe even to one or two words, depending on what we can hear. So.
It's all over, almost. Okay, thank you. That's the end of the tape. I know, brothers and sisters, that how I feel when I'm listening to the wrong sort of music is I feel uncomfortable. I probably feel doubly uncomfortable in an ecclesial hall. But maybe that's the right place to listen to it, because, you see, one of the things with regard to this sort of music, isn't it, is one of the questions we should ask is, if we were sitting next to Christ or the Apostle Paul, would we feel comfortable with what we're playing and what we're listening to? Would we be comfortable with our brothers and sisters with what we're playing or what we're listening to? I was in an ecclesia recently in another place, and we just finished the memorial meeting and we were going somewhere for lunch. And I was invited to go to this family's place for lunch, and the young brother would convey me there, and we hopped into the car, and the first thing that happened, also the radio came on, and a piece of music suspiciously similar to those pieces came on, and we drove all the way to the person's place for lunch with that sort of music, and we just walked out of the sanctuary of God. It doesn't feel right, does it? You just know that you wouldn't sit down next to Christ and listen to certain sorts of music. Remember what we said the other day, that there is some music that stirs all the best and most noble emotions, and there is some music that excites and arouses the baser instincts. And maybe the best way to explain that is just to hear the pieces. Because somehow you do know, don't you? You just know that some of that music is good and some of that music is not good. I'm going to read another extract for you from an article by a Professor Alan Bloom, who wrote a very a book that really condemns the American education system. It's actually called The Closing of the American Mind, but the full title is The Closing of the American Mind: How Higher Education Has Failed Democracy and Impoverished the Souls of Today's Students. And in there, he has an article on music, a significant chapter on music. And talking about pop music, he says, ministering to and according with the arousing and cathartic music, the lyrics celebrate puppy love as well as polymorphous attractions and fortify them against traditional ridicule and shame. The words implicitly and explicitly describe bodily acts and treat them as the only natural and routine culmination for children who do not as yet have the slightest imagination of love, of marriage, or of family. The inevitable corollary of such sexual interest is rebellion against the parental authority that represses it. Selfishness thus becomes indignation and then transforms itself into morality. The sexual revolution must overthrow all the forces of domination, the enemies of nature and happiness. From love comes hate, masquerading as social reform. What were once unconscious or half-conscious childish resentments become the new scripture. And then comes the longing for the classless, prejudice-free, conflictless, universal society that necessarily results from liberated consciousness. We are the world, a pubescent version of our mention, Wirkenbrüder, the fulfillment of which has been inhibited by the political equivalents of mum and dad. These are the three great lyrical themes of pop music. Sex, hate, and a smarmy, hypocritical version of brotherly love. Such polluted sources issue in a muddy stream where only monsters can swim. And this from a man who's not a believer in the word, and not a believer in divine principles. Nothing noble, nothing sublime, profound, delicate, tasteful, or even decent can find a place in such tableau. There is room only for the intense, for the changing, for the crude, and for the immediate. This phenomenon is both astounding and indigestible, and is hardly noticed, routine and habitual, but it is of historic proportions that a society's best young and their best energies should be so occupied. People of future civilizations will wonder at this and find it as incomprehensible as we do the caste system, witch-burning, harems, cannibalism and gladiatorial combats. The fact that the modern age listens to such music, it may well be that society's greatest madness seems normal to itself. Stirring words. For a man whose only interest, by the way, is in education. Not in morality, not the slightest bit interested in morality, just in education and how modern music has totally destroyed the youth of America and closed their minds. So the central theme of pop music, said one of these writers, is narcissism. And at the centre of narcissism, if you want a definition of narcissism, it simply means me. All about self. And so we would instinctively be wary of and careful of any music that was based upon that theme, and that really is the underlying platform of most modern music. Now, I'm not going to answer a particular question. I'm going to leave this for the question section. What about country and western music? What about blues? What about jazz? And what about new age music? Because some of this is seen at least to be a move away from basic rock or pop or metal or whatever. And I think that there has been a movement in the Brotherhood to some of those other things as other possible areas. I've got some thoughts on those. But shall we keep that? Shall we keep that for the purposes of the discussion group to follow? So what do we do then? It's pretty obvious that there is some music that we ought to avoid, some music that doesn't sit comfortably with the objectives of the truth, some music that we wouldn't play if Christ was in our midst, that music which is of itself unhelpful and where the lyrics themselves are all about the theme of self. We'd want to avoid that, wouldn't we? It seems so obvious, so simple, for those who love the truth. But it isn't always simple, is it? So what do we do then? Well, I think we come back to what we said yesterday. It starts in the home. And it starts by homes getting a good grip on good music from a very early age in terms of the development of children. You won't have problems with children later if they've already been brought up in an environment where good music is the norm. So we've got to try and do that. And by the way, even if your children are older, I think there's no time that you oughtn't to start, or no time that says that you can't start. I think that we can do this at any time. In fact, we need to do it at any time. We've got to get the right music into the house, and we've got to create that environment for the enjoyment and the interest in that music. I think the second thing is that that as a recommendation, I think your children should learn musical instruments. I think our children should learn musical instruments. Because I think that in the learning of a musical instrument, two things happen. One is that there is an unlocking of musical appreciation that's different to merely the passive listening of the ear. When someone has tried to play a clarinet or a violin or the piano, the appreciation not only of that instrument but of composition suddenly increases, and of other players who really can play. If a person's never ever played an instrument, they say, oh yeah, that sounds pretty good, but wait till you've tried to learn one of those things. Wait till you've tried to pick up a violin. Wait till you've been a parent and you've endured the screechings, you know, of violin practice, and then see that young person as they listen to Yehudi Menuhin or Yitzhak Perlman or Pinchas Zukerman or Shlomo Mintz or Menachem Breuer or, let's just go through the Jewish violinists, shall we? There's plenty of those. Their appreciation of someone who's good on that instrument grows because they've got some knowledge of what it's like. And if your children are going to learn musical instruments, then I'd like to renew a plea that I made the other day, and that's this, that I think musical instruments ought to be learned properly. We ought to strive for excellence in every field of endeavour. We don't want children who have an organ where they punch buttons and whole chords and things come out. All you've got to do is press a button and it sort of does it for you. That's not learning a musical instrument. Learning a musical instrument is learning it properly. Not necessarily doing it the hard way, but learning it properly, putting the effort in. Because there's a great sense of achievement when the fingering is got correctly, where the sound is coming out properly. There's a marvellous sense of accomplishment in that endeavour itself. We've got to encourage our children to not only learn musical instruments, but to take the time and the energy to learn them properly and to develop real skills. As we've said before, I believe that the instruments of David that were used in the system of worship would have been learnt properly so they could play to perfection, because this was the music of the truth. They oughtn't to make mistakes. So they would practice and practice and practice until they had it right. I think we should take up that spirit in our homes. I think we should practice hymn singing. I know we're going to do it tonight, God willing, after the conclusion of the lecture. That's an excellent thing for every ecclesia. Another thing, by the way, that you could do is to make sure that every so often, once a month or so, you sing an anthem that you haven't sung. Are there any anthems that you don't know? Yes, I think you might find that even Mount Waverley has a few that they haven't yet explored. And one a month would be really good. What we do in our place, in our ecclesia, as I've said before, is we try and learn something new on the basis that once it's learned in a singing practice, we'll try and make sure that it actually turns up in a memorial meeting sooner or later so that it can be sung by the whole congregation, so that our knowledge of the hymn book is expanded. And I think also, and this is a really, it may sound radical, but to me I think it's a good idea, I think we should have more hymn singing at home. You see, before all this sort of music came on board, the music of most families was a piano and singing around the family piano. And singing hymns around the family piano is an act not only of family music, but it's an act of love that the family sings together the praises of the truth. I think it's a fantastic experience. Sort of thing you can do at the end of the reading. So let's sing a hymn, shall we? I think we should do more of that. You know, there's something terrible when you go into meetings, you know, and the presiding brother says, well, we'll now sing, you know, to the glory of God, hymn number so and so, and you've got, well, perhaps particularly young people who stand up and the hand goes in the pocket, because you always have to sing with the hand in your pocket, of course, and then they stare at the floor. Of course, it's mainly young men. Have you noticed that? It tends to be young men rather than young ladies, and then they sit with their eyes glued firmly to the floor because they don't know anything about singing. And either they think it's sissy or they don't know how to do it. But maybe one of the reasons is because not enough things were done at home. Maybe families didn't teach the value and the privilege and the joy of singing at home, so that when young people came to the truth, they knew that singing was natural and that was part of their lives. But we need more of that. We need young people who are passionate about singing and passionate about singing the very best of things. I think we could do it musical appreciation nights. I think musical appreciation nights for either young people or for an ecclesia would be a jolly good idea. Not long, just half an hour at the end of the class. To play a piece of music and to explain what it's about and why it's good and what makes it good and what to listen for and what to hear in the music, so that our knowledge and our understanding grows for the very best of music as opposed to other things that aren't as good. Look, brothers and sisters, I'm going to actually close at that point, which is a little early, but I'd like to make sure that we have room for discussion on some of those things that I may have otherwise covered. I suppose in some ways it was a pity to end up on a negative note of the music that we need to avoid, but I think we all get the message that if God manifestation really is correct and the truth is the first priority in our lives, then everything that we do in life revolves around that idea. We're not free to have other parts of our life that are so unrelated to the truth that they begin to break divine principles. We don't have the music of sanctification and holiness in the memorial meeting and then the throbbing beat of those other sorts of tunes in the car on the way home. You don't do that. You can't do that. They're two different spirits. You put that on in your car when you drive out the door, and everything that was holy about the meeting that day is gone in a flash, hasn't it? In a flash. But we've got to put something good in its place. And fortunately, there's lots of good music that ennobles, that exalts, that exhilarates, that stirs, and that helps us. It's helpful, it's beneficial, and we'll grow in every way in our life in the truth. Ephesians chapter 5. For the fruit of the light, says the Revised Version, for the fruit of the light is in all goodness and righteousness and truth, proving what is acceptable unto the Lord, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them, for it is a shame even to speak of those things which are done of them in secret. But all things that are reproved are made manifest by the light, for whatsoever doth make manifest is light. Wherefore he saith, awake, thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. See then that ye walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Wherefore be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is. And be not drunk with wine, wherein is excess, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, giving thanks always for all things unto God and the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. This is the Spirit, isn't it, brothers and sisters, that ought to guide us in our tastes in everything, including music. Just one last thought. So, hymn 309, by the way, just while we're here in Ephesians 5. You notice that hymn 309 opens with this word, awake my soul, and with the sun thy daily stage of duty running. And I suggested in a talk at some other stage that the word awake, just that one word awake, comes from verse 14 of Ephesians 5. Now the question is, how could I know that and how could I assert that? And the answer lies in the rest of the hymn. So some of you think that's right. You think the word awake in verse 1 of hymn 309 comes from Ephesians 5 verse 14? Yes, could you say that out loud? Redeem the time, verse 16, that verse too, isn't it? Redeem thy misspent time, that's past. Oh yes, I think there's an allusion here to Ephesians chapter 5, verses 14 to 16. And if that's the case, then the word awake does come from Ephesians, probably in thought, in the very first line here of hymn 390. This is all part of this scriptural sleuthing, isn't it? That makes the hymns interesting. That's the background. Hymn 309 is drawn in spirit from Ephesians 5, and Ephesians 5 is going to end up by saying that we ought to make melody in our hearts to the Lord, giving thanks to him in all things. And the hymn is going to end up with this thought, brothers and sisters, awake and lift up thyself, my heart, and with the angels bear thy part, who evermore unwearied sing high praise to the eternal King. Isn't this yet another hymn that breathes the spirit of God's manifestation, brothers and sisters, the supremacy of God, not of man. Let us make that sort of melody and enjoy that sort of music that will help us in all things to give thanks unto God who made us and who in the very making of us, brothers and sisters, endowed us with the capacity for the love and appreciation of all things musical.